My desk is an ash table with no drawers. I don't keep supplies or records in my office. Asia's much larger room is the repository for files and office materials. "Have a seat," I said to the nervous girl. She considered the request a moment, then sat on one of the ash chairs set out for visitors.
"It's an unusual office,"
she said, her head moving from side to side.
"Why are you so jumpy?"
I don't know. I mean, I guess being here means that I'm really going to do this. You know, when you just think about doing something, it still isn't quite real?
"I know what you mean," I said, with more feeling than I intended. Willa, I believe, heard the honesty in my tone, and this seemed to relax her.
"My name is Willa Portman."
"You said that already."
"I'm an intern doing research work for Stuart Braun."
"Stuart Braun? Now, that's a big deal."
"Yeah," she said through a sneer. "He is a big deal. A very important lawyer for those people no one else cares about."
Stuart Braun was the radical lawyer celeb who was representing a free man, a black militant journalist who had been arrested for the killing of two police officers 3 years earlier. Born Leonard Compton, man was found seriously wounded a few blocks from the shootout in the Far West Village. The gun he had on him was the one used in killing the officers. The bullets had passed clean through his body, so the guns that shot him could not be identified. Man refused to implicate anyone else who might have been with him that night, and denied having anything to do with any murders. He was facing the death penalty, which New York State provides for cop killers. He showed no remorse and, in general, refused to cooperate with the police or prosecutors. Before Braun got involved, it seemed pretty clear that New York was going to have its first execution in a very long time. The Braun machine, as it was known, took the case to a new level. An appeal was granted after Braun showed that much of the evidence against his client had been circumstantial and his publicly assigned lawyers were incompetent. Newspapers suggested that a self-defense plea was in the making. Protests proclaiming "free man" were being held from coast to coast. I wasn't a fan. When it came to cops as victims, I was just another brick in the blue wall. Few civilians understood how hard it is to be a policeman when almost everybody is afraid of you and suspicious, too. The mayor, the city council, and half the civilian population were willing to believe the worst of us when we put our lives on the line 24/7. Us. I still consider myself a cop. In my days on the force, I'd been sucker-punched, stabbed, spit on, shot at, and singled out by 1,000 video phones. Every time I'd make an arrest, the community seemed to come out against me. They had no idea how much we cared about them. Their lives. "So, are you a lawyer, Miss Portman?"
"I passed the bar this past June," she said. "But I'm working for Braun because he does the kind of work I want to do."
"And what does Stuart Braun want from me?" I asked.
"Nothing."
"Then why are you here?"
"I'm here because Mr. Mann is innocent, and Stuart Braun is about to sell him down the stream," the young woman replied.
"River," I said.
"What?"
"The saying is, sell him down the river."
"Oh."
Willa looked at me with both desperation and anger in her eyes. "I thought Braun had committed himself to saving man," I said.
"He had," she said. "At first. He gathered all kinds of evidence against the cops that Manny shot."
"He's admitted to the murders?"
No.
Willa Portman stuttered.
"I mean, yes, but not the way you're saying. They were trying to kill him. They were stalking him. They'd already murdered 3 of his blood brothers and paralyzed the other one. They were after him, and he just protected himself."
She'd been looking around while making these claims, but ended the sentence by looking into my eyes. "So," I prompted, "Braun was gathering evidence?"
"He had days and times, ballistics reports, and testimony from reliable witnesses who could be vetted."
"Sounds like a case."
"It was. It is. But then, 2 weeks ago, Stuart, I don't know, he turned cold. There really isn't any other way to say it. We were supposed to go see a church lady named Johanna Mudd. Ms. Mutt had agreed to testify that Officer Valance received payments from Deacon Mordecai to provide access to young homeless people for the purpose of forced prostitution.
Run out of a church?
The Last Rite of Christ Baptist Church ran a charity that was supposed to help runaway and orphaned girls and boys. Mordecai and some of his friends had the access. Valance, Officer Pratt, and others ran the business.
So that's the defense? I asked. That man and his crew were fighting a prostitution ring?
Not just that, she said. Not just that. Manny says that the cops were involved in all kinds of criminal activities. There was stolen merchandise, drugs, and murders. People were being killed if they tried to stand up to them.
But then one morning the Honorable Mr. Braun went cold, you say.
I asked him when we were going to leave to see Ms. Mudd, and he said that we weren't. I asked why, and he told me that everything a free man had told us was a lie, that he was the one who had killed his blood brothers because they were going to turn in Valance and Pratt.
Eugene Yolo Valance and Anton Pratt were the cops Mann had been convicted of killing. They were decorated uniforms who often worked as bodyguards for the mayor and visiting dignitaries. Maybe Braun's telling the truth, I suggested. I know too many innocent cops who have been blamed for crimes they didn't commit. I was one of them.
Ms. Mudd has disappeared,
Willa said.
I went to talk to her a few days later, after failing to get her on the phone. Her son Rondru told me that she was missing. He said that she went to meet Stuart and never returned.
I sighed. It was an unexpected exhalation. This I knew was due to the fact that the prospective client had caught my interest. She clasped her hands and looked down at the hardwood floor.
Hi.
Asia was standing at the door. She was smiling, her short hair standing up at various angles like a field of spiky wild grasses. Her blue jeans might as well have been painted on, and her blouse didn't come anywhere near the waistline. I wanted to ask if this was within the boundaries of the school dress code, but then Willa looked up, tears streaming from her eyes.
Oh, baby,
my daughter exclaimed. She rushed to the lawyer's side, kneeled down, and hugged her. Between my sudden breath and Asia's concern, I knew that I'd spend at least a day or two investigating Portman's case.
Come on with me.
Asia was helping the sad young woman rise from the chair. After liftoff, they made their way to the washroom annexed to the outer office. In their absence, I tried to see a connection between Beatrice's letter and the case of a free man. I knew that there was no direct link, but the similarities might be a way for me to solve a case close enough to my own so that I might feel some sense of closure without returning to Rikers. If man was innocent and I freed him, then it would be, in some way, like freeing myself. I was looking out the window again.
I'm sorry, Mr. Oliver, Willa Portman said to my back. You want me to take notes, Daddy?
I want you to go down to the drugstore, I said, and pick me up a pack of those little notebooks I use.
But I could take notes here.
Go on. I stood up to underscore my directive. The words between familiars often mean a lot less than tones and looks. Asia saw that I needed her gone from the office, and she obeyed. Through the open door, I could see A.D. collecting her bag and going out the front. I waited maybe 10 seconds and then sat down again facing the dewy-eyed girl. You see how much trouble there is in this, I said.
Is that why you asked Asia to leave?
She's my daughter, and you're 12 miles of bad road. Willa winced. If even one thing you told me is true, I said, then there's bad news and murder to go all the way round.
But Manny's innocent, she cried.
I thought he was married.
Huh?
The way you talk about him, it sounds like you're his girlfriend.
No.
Really? The way she looked up at me almost made me grin. The magnetism between young lovers, even when they're old, is the gravity of the soul. Undeniable, unquestionable, and, sooner or later, unwanted.
Only once, she said. When Stuart had another case to attend to and I was recording Manny's deposition, I respect Marin. She's the mother of their child, but because they aren't legally married, they won't even let her visit except behind a plexiglass barrier. He needed somebody.
Johanna Mudd has really disappeared?
Yes.
And Braun has pulled back on the case.
He shredded the files,
she claimed.
He said that they were all lies.
So the evidence is gone. She reached over, putting her hand on the roller bag.
When I got the job working for Mr. Braun, my college advisor, Sharon Middleman, told me that I should always make copies in case something went missing. Mr. Braun didn't want the files stored electronically. He said that hackers could get into any memory device. So I'd come in at night to use the copy machine.
How much do you have? I asked, my respect for the prospective client rising with each word.
3,317 two-sided sheets.
6,000 pages?
Closer to 7.
7,000 pages. Suddenly, I was scared. Any evidence is a detective's friend, but I imagined reading through the pages while some shadow crept up behind me with a loaded pistol in its all-too-solid hand. You know, I can't do work pro bono like Braun, I said, flailing around for an exit strategy. She put the briefcase on the table and opened it, revealing stacks and stacks of paper-slip-bound $50 bills.
Almost $19,000, she said. It's half of an inheritance I got from my grandmother. I know we can't go to the police, and also we can't have any connection between us. I've been taking money out of the account, $1,000 at a time. I want you to prove Manny innocent and get him released from prison.
What if he wants to go back to Marin? I asked.
If you love someone, you set them free,
she said, with all the force of the pop song. Looking at the pretty young woman with the sad, sad face, I thought about the last 24 hours and how much I had changed. Between Congressman Akers and Beatrice Summers, I was on the verge of becoming someone. Something new. On the verge, but not quite across the line. Hold on to that money for another day, I said.
Why?
I'm going to look over these papers and make up my mind then.
Everything I'm saying is true.
That may be, but still, I have to convince myself.
But you're my only hope. Manny's only hope.
Why do you even think you can trust me? I asked, the divine words leaping from my lips like Athena from Zeus's brow.
Jacob Starl.
7. Jacob was the son of Thomas and Margarita Storrell. The father owned and ran a small hardware store on the Lower East Side, and the mother was the director of a private women's club called Dryads. Tom sold hammers and nails, while Rita and her friends prayed to the spirits of trees. The wife called me after reading the top line of my ad in the yellow pages, King Detective Service, because of the word service. She felt that there was duty and dignity in the use of such a word. That was 8 years ago. The divorce was dragging, and Monica's lawyer had threatened to have my new accounts attached if I didn't pay her initial fee. I needed a job, any job. Tom Storrell told me that his son had been arrested for robbery. He'd gone into a stationery store, also in the East Village, and emptied the cash register while the clerk was with a customer somewhere in a back aisle. The police were called and happened to only be seconds away. They arrested Jacob before he had made it to the corner. He needs a lawyer, I advised, not a detective. The police have a videotape, Tom said with hopeless conviction.
But we are sure he would never do such a thing, Margarita added. He's so good-hearted that ever since he was a child, the other children would get him into trouble. Go see him. Look at the evidence. It would be a service.
So, for a down payment of $80 on 400, I went to the precinct in the East Village and asked to see my client. You're the one they got for misconduct, right? The desk sergeant asked. Falsely accused, I replied. The 50-something cop was beefy but pale. There were errant hairs on his otherwise clean-shaven jowls, and his eyes had almost given up on color altogether. I was standing 3 feet away from him but imagined a rank scent and took half a step back. Interrogation room 9, the sergeant told me. I never got his name. He handed me a clear plastic badge with a red card in it. The card identified me as V9. Walking down the corridor toward the interrogation room area, I was struck by sudden claustrophobia. The walls seemed to want to move in on me. The floor felt uneven, and the imagined smell of the unnamed sergeant was pungent in my nostrils. I stumbled and righted myself with my left hand against the encroaching wall.
"Whoa, brother,"
a man said, putting a hand under my left arm.
"You okay?"
He was Asian, probably Chinese, wearing a patrolman's uniform and black-rimmed, round-lensed glasses. His eyes were friendly, and he didn't smell at all.
"Thanks," I said. "I guess the days kind of add up."
"And count down," he added.
"Aren't you Joe Oliver?"
"Yeah."
"Man, they fucked you. If I had been the detective on that investigation, nobody would ever have seen a tape. I mean, you didn't hit her or nothing."
Back then, this was new fodder for my discontent. Of course, a brother in blue would lose evidence like that. And the police were always the first eyes on the scene.
"Thanks,"
I said, standing up straight.
"What's your name?"
"Archie. Archie Zhao."
"Interrogation room 9 up ahead, Archie. Just around the corner." The IRs were no more than broom closets in that precinct. When I opened the self-locking door, the solitary occupant flinched in his chair and put his hands up as far as the restraints would allow. He was a short, pudgy young man in jeans and a long-sleeved plaid shirt. He'd been beaten pretty badly by the look of his face. The left eye was completely closed and his lower lip had been busted up. There was a lump the size of a golf ball on his right cheekbone.
"I'll confess if you want me to,"
he said. That was all he needed to say. I had been him not long before. There were moments when I would have said anything to stop the fear of what might happen next. "Your mother sent me, Jacob."
"She did?"
When I opened wide, while the others strained for sight. "You okay?"
"They hit me. They hit me hard."
"Did you steal that money?"
"Are you going to take me home?"
From the looks of him, I would have said he was mid-20s, but he spoke like and had the manner of a child. "Not right this minute, but if you answer my questions truthfully, I'll do my best to prove you innocent." That's when he started crying. He put his head in his chained hands and blubbered. I took the seat across from his side of the detainment table and waited. After a while, the crying became fearful and louder. He started yelling and trying to pull himself free from the cuffs that were attached by a chain, threaded through a hole in the table to a steel eye anchored in the concrete floor. I remained silent, allowing him to vent. I knew the feeling. After a while, he calmed down and sat up, after a fashion.
"I'm sorry,"
he murmured. "No blame," I said. "Here you get arrested for something you didn't do, and then they beat you for telling the truth." Jacob looked at me with his Quasimodo eye. I asked, "Why did you take the money out of the cash register?"
"Sheila told me I could."
"Who is Sheila?"
"A friend I met."
"Met where?"
"In the park on Bowery. She said her father had a store and that he'd give us some money for dinner. She was very hungry."
The whole thing took about 3 hours. I got Officer Zhao to let me see the security tape from the scene. It was obvious that someone off camera was telling Jacob what to do, probably Sheila. And it was likely that she had another friend who lured the counter clerk into a conversation in a back aisle. The arresting officer's report said that there was no money found on the suspect. He was only 3 doors down, and the money had already been taken from him. The detective in charge of the interrogation was Buddy McEnery, a contemporary of mine who took shortcuts every chance he could. I had a rep, too. I liked the ladies, and I was a stickler for details. Almost all of my arrests ended up in convictions. I convinced Buddy to access other security cameras in the area to try to get an image of Jacob leaving. "I'm sure you'll get a shot of a girl and a guy, or maybe 2 girls, who fooled the kid."
"He still did the taking,"
Buddy, a swarthy Irishman, said. "Have you talked to him?"
"Sure,"
he said.
"With this."
He held up his left fist. I refrained from hitting him and said, I'm sure his high school records will say that he's a special needs student.
A retard?
Let me take him home, bud, before you and the department get sued. McEnery wore a gray suit that had gained its silvery sheen with age. He stared at me, distaste outlining his lips, and finally said,
You're not one of us anymore, are you?
Jacob's a good kid, I said to Willa, but I don't think of him as a trustworthy reference.
Jackie was a stock boy in my father's hardware store, she said. He was kind of like my friend. He told me about you, and his mother said that you were able to get him out of jail in just a few hours. When I asked her about using you, she told me that you were committed to service and truth.
I don't believe in the supernatural, but some people I've met seem to see things that are hidden from me. I don't know if it's intelligence or a mode of perception beyond my understanding, but there are those whom I trust beyond the borders of simple logic. Margarita Storrow, though I had met her only once, was one of these people.
So, you'll go over the papers tonight?
The untried lawyer asked. Give me $250 from the cash, and I'll read it. Maybe I'll have some advice about it, maybe not.
Maybe you'll take the case, if you think there's some merit?
I waited 4 heartbeats before saying, Maybe. Willa departed, and for a while I was alone and at peace the way a soldier during World War I was at peace in the trenches, waiting for the next attack, the final flu, or maybe mustard gas seeping over the edge of a trench that might be his grave. I was thinking about Acres and Summers and, now, man, too. To get my mind off these troubles, I logged onto my IP, hoping for good news or at least a worthwhile ad. The 17th email in the list was from bacres1119@repbacres.com. The only message was a phone number. 8. After work, I took Asia Denise to a new French bistro on Montague called Le Sauvage. I had boeuf bourguignon and she coq au vin. The red wine was good, and I only let her have a sip.
Are you going to take Willis' case?
She asked, after I refused her a second taste. How much did she tell you about it?
That guy, a free man, is innocent, and she thinks you can prove it?
You can't mention that to anyone, I said.
I won't. I'm just talking to you.
A man 2 tables away was giving us side glances now and then. There's another thing, I said.
What?
Do you use the computer I gave you?
Yeah. Why?
Do you ever take it home?
It's a laptop, but it weighs 12 pounds. I wouldn't take that thing anywhere.
So you never took it home?
Uh-uh,
she uttered. But there was a look of hesitation in her eye. What?
The files are on the cloud. I usually download the work to my computer once a week to catch up on things I might not have finished. Is there anything wrong with that?
I love my daughter. If I had to spend the rest of my life in a moldy coffin buried under 10 feet of concrete with only polka music to listen to, I would have done that for her.
Is something wrong, Daddy?
No, honey. It's kind of late. I'll give you a ride home.
Okay. Are you going to take the man case?
She asked as we stood. Please don't ever mention that name again. Not to your mother. Not to anyone.
Okay.
She looked at me pleadingly to underscore the promise. I was parked right off Montague, but before we got very far, someone called to us.
Excuse me,
he said. He approached us from the front of Le Sauvage. I wondered if I had forgotten something. It was the man who had been giving us glances, a white guy standing at about 5'9", wearing a green and yellow sports jacket with black shirt and trousers.
Excuse me,
he said again as he reached us. His shoes looked as if they had been woven from straw.
You don't have to go with him, he said to my daughter.
Huh?
Was her reply. I didn't know whether to give him an uppercut or a kiss on the lips. You got it wrong, man, I said. This is my daughter. He blinked, and then took a closer look. The resemblance is there if you look past the optimism and the pain.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Excuse me, I thought...
Look, I added, I appreciate you looking out for a young woman, but there's no trouble here.
You thought he was my boyfriend?
My innocent daughter proclaimed incredulously.
I lost my youngest to the street, he said, addressing me.
Next time, you should take a cell phone picture and call the cops, I suggested. Safer all the way around. The ride out to Plum Beach was fun. Asia loved listening to Sidney Bechet because
his horn sounded like somebody talking.
I told her the story about how Bechet got involved in a duel with another musician in Paris because the guy had told him he played the wrong notes.
Really?
She said.
Did he shoot the other guy?
They were better jazzmen than they were marksmen. Some bystander got shot. I think it was a woman.
Like me, if I talk about your cases, she said.
Probably not, but maybe. Monica's husband came to the door of their three-story whitestone. He was expecting my daughter to come alone. Joe, he said. Coleman. What are you doing here?
Daddy has to talk to Mom, Asia said with authority in her tone.
About what? Coleman Tesseract addressed the question to me.
Joe?
Monica called from the second floor landing. Hey, Monica, I said. I have to talk to you about something.
Call me tomorrow.
Can't, I said. It's L.A.D. I managed not to smile at the frown that twisted into Coleman's lips. He wanted Asia to call him Daddy and resented the fact that his wife and I had a secret abbreviation system to communicate with. My ex-wife harumphed and then said,
Let me put something on. I'll meet you in the kitchen. I'll keep you company till she comes,
my daughter said. You will go to bed, Coleman said. He was a light-skinned Negro with handsome features. My height, he was 10 years younger than my ex. Coleman was an investment banker and pretty well off, the kind of man who liked owning things, or at least controlling them. I appreciated this quirk in his personality because it alienated my daughter. The evil look she gave him was cute on a sheltered 17-year-old. But one day, Coleman and Monica would experience the hatred seething underneath.
Okay,
Asia said. Then she kissed me on the cheek and whispered, Good night. I went through the first floor sitting room to a smaller dining area and into the L-shaped kitchen. I sat at the small table where the family of three ate breakfast and sometimes dinner. I was thinking of the best way to broach the serious talk that she and I needed to have. L.A.D. meant life and death in our code system. Hearing that, she knew I meant business. Maybe 15 minutes later, Monica came in wearing a teal sweatsuit. Coleman followed. He was clad in jeans and a black T-shirt. Well, he asked, what is it? Tell him to leave, I said to my ex.
You don't order me in my house, Coleman said.
Please, Cece,
Monica said in almost a whisper. He wanted to fight. I did, too. Instead, he turned away, walked through the rooms to the stairs, and stomped his way to bed like Rumpelstiltskin after a hard day making gold on his Wall Street spinning wheel. When we were both sure that he was gone, she said,
What is it?
You mess with me all the time, Em. I replied. Send me threatening letters. Have lawyers send me threatening letters. And every once in a while, you try and get at me through AD. That's cool. I take it in stride. I don't come to you and ask, why didn't you do something to help me, your daughter's father, when they were trying to bury me under the prison?
You know why, she said, like Moses on high.
And so you do this, I asked, running my finger along the deep scar down the right side of my face.
I didn't cut you.
But you could have stopped it from happening. You could have gotten up off our monies and made my bail.
I had to worry about our daughter, her future.
Yeah, I somewhat agreed. And the best way to protect her is to make sure I keep paying for what she needs to live.
Coleman provides.
But it helps to have that extra check, I mean, even his six figures would be stretched trying to fit the bill at Columbia.
What do you want, Joe?
I'd like it if you didn't try and get me shot. The look on her face was that of an innocent listening to the ravings of an idiot. When you called Bob Acres, I continued, you didn't know what the circumstances were. The dismissal in her gaze faded. Monica had been a beautiful young woman. She had deep brown skin and features that spoke of Western Africa. She was loving and sexy, smart and loyal. I had betrayed her. There was no excuse for that. But it was enough that she let me languish at Rikers. You wanting a man I'm investigating could end up getting me killed. What if I decided to investigate Coleman? What kind of dirt you think I could dig up on him? I knew at least part of the answer to that question. I was pretty sure she did, too.
I never heard of a Bob Acres, she said lamely. Is that congressman?
He sent me the number of the person who warned his aide. Your cell phone number.
Coleman has nothing to do with this.
Take me to court. Report me to the authorities when I'm 6 days late on a support payment. Tell my daughter exactly what I did to make you so mad, I listed. But fuck with my work again, and I will make you regret it. I will torpedo this perfect life you got so bad that you won't even be able to come up for air. Do you understand that? I didn't wait for an answer. I just stood up and retraced my steps to their front door and walked out to the street. There was a chill in the air. I liked it. 9. One flight up from my second floor office is the apartment where I live. It too has an 18-foot ceiling and two magnificent windows that look out on the gentrifying thoroughfare. I have ceiling to floor deep red curtains cut from a light fabric derived, somehow, from bamboo. I open them at night because the lights are on at the front of the room and no one can see in. My entire apartment is one big room and a water closet. I have a footed, deep basin iron bathtub, a king-size bed on a 3-foot-high dais, and a mahogany desk that's more than 100 years old. Leaving the rest of the room dark, I turned on the desk lamp and opened the suitcase full of records that Willa Portman brought. Either Willa or her boss was very organized. A blue folder set atop the great pile of paper was an index that pretty much laid out the defense for a free man, nay, Leonard Compton. It contained his personal history, his political involvements, his work and military experience, and the events leading up to the night that Officers Valance and Pratt were killed. Laid upon the table of contents page of the blue folder was a 3x5 photograph of a smiling middle-aged black woman. The smile revealed a golden upper front tooth, and the eyes told of intelligence and certainty. Etched in red along the bottom of the photograph was the name Johanna Mudd. Willa Portman, I was sure, had placed that picture there because the disappearance of Ms. Mudd was the reason for the investigation. When he was still Leonard Compton, Mann served as a master sergeant in the Rangers. He'd received high scores as a marksman and had won many medals, at least hinting at his bravery and nationalism. When he left the armed forces, he went to City College and then became a high school teacher in Upper Manhattan, where he worked hard to keep his charges, boys and girls, out of trouble. Leonard wrote articles for a small uptown paper called The People's Clarion. He started out writing about his military experience, but as time passed, he began to detail crimes done to young people in and around the black neighborhoods of New York City. At some point along the way, he joined, or maybe started, a group called the Blood Brothers of Broadway. This group consisted of 5 men and 2 women. Tanya Lark had been one of Mann's success stories. She was a gang-banging killer who scared everybody she met until he showed her that anger and violence could be redirected to help the community. Greg Lohman was a security guard for Trickster Enterprises, a toy company that had diversified, according to Bronze sources, into various technological concerns. Lohman was a black member of the NRA and a solid believer in every American's right to defend him or herself. Christopher Kit Carson had done 6 stints in jail, mostly for burglary. One of these was due to an arrest that Pratt had made.
Son Molly was an Africanist who believed that one day a revolution would tear the United States apart. His day job was that of a master plumber. Lamont Charles was the slickest member of the Blood Brothers of Broadway. He was a suspected con man who had never been charged, a Lothario of almost mythic proportions, and a poker player so devastating that he was allowed in only certain professional games from Atlantic City to Las Vegas. Lana Ruiz was a Dominican who had cut the throat of her pimp in his sleep, but somehow managed to get a judge to call it self-defense. Her picture was that of a beautiful, dark-skinned woman who seemed defiant, even while smiling for the photograph. The BBB was not a fortunate lot. Loman, Carson, and Molly had all been murdered in the 18 months preceding Mann's shootout with Pratt and Valance. Lamont Charles had been shot, but he survived, a triplegic living in a nursing home on Coney Island. Lana Ruiz had been convicted of armed assault and attempted murder, while Tanya Lark had dropped off the map completely. That was a whole lot of mayhem, even for a militant political group, even for a Saturday night in summertime in Brownsville, New York. There was a long list of witnesses who had claimed that the dead cops were involved in criminal activities, and two witnesses who had first claimed that the cops opened fire on Mann. They gave nearly identical testimony, only to recant within 3 days of each other. Even though Braun hadn't mentioned it in his arguments, I couldn't see why the former Leonard Compton would decide to take on the cops in a one-on-two shootout. He was a marksman, and they trained professionals. Why not set himself up on some roof and take them out when they were on a job? And why drop a case just because the client might have been guilty? It was the lawyer's job to work with the law, not worry about right and wrong. I must have read 400 pages when I noticed that it was closing in on 5 a.m. I should have gone to bed, but all that evidence gave me a thought. If Adamo Cortez wasn't actually the name of an NYPD cop, then maybe it was an official alias or a confidential informant. It was at that moment I knew that I was going to take both cases, my frame and a free man's murder conviction. I was born to be an investigator. For me, it was like putting together a three-dimensional, naturalistic puzzle that in the end would be an exact representation of the real world. From the deep bottom drawer of my ancient desk, I took out two reams of paper, both pastel-colored, one blue and the other pink. That way my outline of the two investigations could be stacked together while following two different strands. I had, in my failed career, used as many as 5 colors to keep my place. I'd been paid $250 to work an 8-hour day, seeing if the two investigations made sense. I had a clear pathway because nobody knew what I was up to. For the first step, I took a white sheet from the top drawer and penned across the top, common elements. The first question, mutually shared by both cases, was whether or not I needed a partner in the process. I considered Gladstone Palmer. He was my friend. There was no doubt about that. He went into Rikers and made sure that I was safe and solitary. When I was working a 70-hour week at 2 security jobs, he lent me the money to start the detective service, then sent me my first few clients. And Glad knew how the department worked. He was connected to every precinct, every captain, and most foot soldiers of the NYPD. His input would be invaluable, and if he was able to clear my name, he might also clear a pathway to his own advancement. But Glad's strengths were also deficits. He did know all the important players on and off the force, and so might be beholden to people I'd have to hurt. Add to that the fact that I was trying to clear a cop killer of the crimes he was accused of while admitting that he pulled the trigger, that would be of no help to my friend. Patrolman First Class Henri Tourneau was another choice. The young Haitian-born cop's father asked me to help him prepare for getting on the force. I guided Henri through every step, including training himself in computers so that he'd have a skill that most prospective cops lacked. Once he was in, I counseled him on how to deal with everything, from his captain to the rank and file. I told him what rules could be bent or broken, and those that were sacrosanct. One thing he was never to do was admit that I was anything other than a friend of his father's.
Henri allowed me to roam through the general databases, but using him as a partner in these investigations was above and beyond for the young and recently married policeman. Nor the cop fit the bill, and so I let my thoughts range wider. There were half a dozen PIs I knew from work I'd done over the years, but I wasn't close enough to any of them to feel they could be trusted with issues so serious. The sun was beginning to peek over the bank building across the street when I thought, reluctantly, of Melquoth Frost. Melquoth, or Mel, as he was better known, was a vicious criminal. Mel had done many things wrong in his life. He'd robbed banks, murdered rivals, tortured marks, set bombs, and belonged to a few dangerous heist crews that had executed some of the most daring robberies of the 21st century so far. I came across the lifelong criminal when the FBI tasked a few city cops to shore up some gaps in a net they set for the Byron gang. Ted and Francis Byron were truly architects of crime. They had planned and carried out at least 8 bank burglaries, where they were able to blast out an inner wall through to cash-gorged vaults. On these jobs, they always took along a man like Mel, in case there was a need to fight. The job was done at a little after 3 on a Wednesday morning in a midtown bank on West 56th. I was guarding a subway grate on 63rd that the Fed said might be used as an exit. It was just me because they didn't think it likely that anyone would get that far, and the brass was charging them $2,500 a head for boots on the ground. I listened to the takedown over a secure line that all the participants had. The explosion had come at 3:09. Soon after that, 6 of the 7 bank robbers were captured without a round being fired. There was a lot of chatter over the 7th perp. I stayed at my post because that was the job, and I always did my job, unless there was a woman somewhere in the way. 32 minutes after the takedown, the grate to the subway lifted slightly. I watched from shadow, timing my intervention. I could have called for backup, but by then the suspect would have escaped. I could have shot him in the leg or foot, or killed him for that matter. But that's just not the kind of man I am. So instead, I waited until one hand shot up out of the ground, snapped a cuff on it, and quickly attached the other link to the heavy metal grating. Then I put the muzzle of my service revolver to the man's head and said, "Let me see that other paw, and it better be empty." I received the Medal of Exceptional Merit for the arrest, bestowed upon me by the chief himself. The FBI had me go to their headquarters, where the local director shook my hand. All that honor went away when Melquoth was put on trial. The other 6 bank robbers were tried together, but because Mel was captured alone and quite far from the scene, his lawyer, Eugenia Potok, was able to separate him from the rest. Before I was to testify, the prosecutor interviewed me, suggesting that maybe I heard the accused admit to being involved with the crime. The other men refused to bear witness against one another, and so had Mel. I could not, in good conscience, say anything but what I knew on the stand. I had determined early on in my career that as a cop, I would always adhere to the letter and the spirit of the law. Law, for me, was scripture. Melquoth beat the charges, and I was transferred to night duty on Staten Island for the next 3 years. Time passed. I was framed, incarcerated, and thrown out on my ear. So, it's easy to understand how I might have forgotten all about Melquoth. And then, only 2 years ago, I was sitting in my office, looking out the window, and thinking about solitary confinement. "Mr. Oliver," Tara Grandisle, Asia's predecessor, said over the intercom.
"Yes, Tara."
"A Mr. Johnson to see you."
"Who?"
"He says he wants to discuss a case with you."
As far as I knew, this Mr. Johnson was just another prospective client. I had no idea that he was the man who earned me 3 years on a Staten Island boat.
"Send him in," I said, pocketing my snub-nosed 32 just for insurance. When Melquoth Frost walked through the door, I nearly pulled my weapon. My visitor smiled and held his arms out, revealing open palms. I hit the intercom and said, "We need some pumpernickel for the pastrami."
"Okay,"
Tara said. That was our code for her to clear out.
"Mr. Oliver," Mel said.
Melquoth Frost.
You can call me Mel. All my friends do.
I'm not your friend.
That might be, he said. But I'm yours. Can I sit down?
I thought about the request a beat longer than was civil, and then said, sure. He was wearing a medium gray suit that was loose enough for freedom of movement, but tailored in such a way to look businesslike. What can I do for you?
Just did 3 on a nickel in Joliet, he said, as if this was somehow an answer to my question. My second conviction, and my last.
The man was the opposite of his suit. He was lean and dangerous-looking, with olive skin, short brown hair, and dark eyes that women must have adored. His hands were heavily muscled. You bought a suicide pill or something? I asked.
Guy shot me in the back when we were through with a bank job, Mel said. Shot me right there in the bank for 16% divided by 5.
He shook his head in disgust. And he's out here somewhere?
No.
Melkworth Frost just twisted his lips, and I felt a twinge of fear.
He hooked up with a girlfriend of mine after the job.
So maybe it wasn't just the 1/5 of 16%. Mel smiled, and then grinned.
He was supposed to meet her at the carving table in North Chicago one night, and someone shot him in the eye.
All that public knowledge?
Instead of answering me, he went on. Cops saved my life, and then did this pissant job of framing me. They shoved money from the bank in my pocket, but my lawyer proved it wasn't me put it there. I had an illegal firearm on me. If they had let it alone, I'd have gotten 12 years. But they had to deal it down if the cops didn't want to be caught doing what they do.
Another thing I noticed about my visitor was the way he sat. His legs were spread wide. He pulled over an empty chair and laid his left wrist on top of the backrest. His right hand lay on his knee. It was as if he was at home, enjoying life more than a billionaire. He gazed at the space above my head, thinking about a hard life with a sense of elan and maybe even a little whimsy. So, I said, before he tried to move in.
I got 5 years, and from the first day, they had me in solitary confinement.
I must have winced, because a smile flitted across the career criminal's lips. He nodded slightly.
It almost broke me, he continued. Almost did. I remember shouting for days. Then I cried. And finally one morning, I guess it was morning because that's when I woke up. On that morning, I found the peace to think about my life. I went over the whole thing from grade school to solitary, and you know what I figured?
Not in the least.
That in all that time, you were the only one treating me fair.
What the fuck? I arrested you for bank robbery.
You could have shot me. You could have hit me in the head with a lead pipe. You sure as shit could have testified that I had somehow mentioned the bank job. I know your bosses were mad when you didn't lie.
Mel leaned forward, now with both hands on his thighs. So you came here from Illinois to thank me? I asked.
I already told you, he said. I'm not going back to prison. I came out here to ply my old trade and to tell you that if you ever need a good turn, I owe you a few.
That was a very important nexus for me. It was rare for anyone to see in me what I saw in the mirror. Melkorth might have been a villain, but he was a villain with my number in his pocket. I wasn't about to share that intelligence with him. What kind of trade? I asked.
Watchmaker.
Really? When I was 14, they wanted to put me in juvie for assault and battery. The judge gave me a choice of enrolling in an after-school program or being locked up. I chose watchmaking with a little Jew named Harry Slotkin who did watch repair on Cherry Lane. He taught me a lot. Later on, I applied that knowledge to bomb making, but in my spare time, I studied watches.
You know, I said, that even though I'm no longer a cop, I'm still on the other side of the line from you.
He laid a small white business card on the desk and said,
I hear you play chess.
Yes, I do.
Chessboard is a neutral place.
I go to Washington Square Park in Greenwich Village most Mondays, Wednesdays, and Saturdays.
I play there. Numbers on the card.
If you ever want to match wits across that line, just give me some warning and I'll have the board set up. He rose from his chair with ease. He nodded instead of holding out a hand. I nodded back, and he left. I looked up the name Melquoth on the internet soon after he left. He'd been a patron god to Hannibal before the general attacked Europe. He was also associated with Baal, considered by Western religion to be a manifestation of Satan. Over the next 2 years since then, we've played about a dozen games. After the third, which he won, we got a drink together. After the fifth, which he also won, we had a meal. 10. It wasn't yet 7 a.m. when I climbed the concrete stairs to the raised pedestrian walkway across the Brooklyn Bridge. There was a chill in the morning air, but I had my windbreaker on, a sweater beneath that. Pedestrian traffic was still pretty light at that time of day, and the breezes can get a little stiff. The combination of solitude and cold somehow imparted the feeling of freedom, so much so that I was on the brink of laughter. I knew these emotions indicated an instability of mind, but I didn't care. A man can live his whole life following the rules set down by happenstance and the cash-coded bait of security-cosseted morality, an entire lifetime, and in the end, he wouldn't have done one thing to be proud of. It was a 49-minute walk from Montague Street to Manhattan. Once in the rich man's borough, I went past City Hall all the way to the west side, where I turned left on Hudson. 3 blocks down, there was a diner called Dinah's across the street from Stonemason's rest home.
"Mr. Oliver,"
Dinah Hawkins said in greeting when I sat down at the counter.
"I haven't seen you in 3 months."
"I usually go straight over, Dee, but today I wanted to stretch my legs and think."
"You didn't walk here all the way from Brooklyn, did you?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"It's not good for your health to overdo, Mr. Oliver."
Dinah was a good-sized woman who worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well past 60, she had biceps bigger than mine, and I was sure that she could work alongside most longshoremen with no great strain. "It's the only exercise I get," I lied.
"You're looking good enough without it."
Her Irish green eyes sparkled, and I knew that she was what her father would have called a hellion when she was younger.
"Got any interesting cases?"
she asked, putting the mug of black coffee at my station. I discussed my job with certain people who had nothing to do with law enforcement, but when it came to my new cases, I couldn't be quiet enough. "I had this public figure like to do threesomes with T-girls," I said.
"What's that mean? Tiger girl?"
"I think the street term is chicks with dicks." The bell to the door behind me sounded. In the mirror, I saw a young man wearing a suit designed for an older and probably more successful banker. The young man, he was somewhere in his mid-20s, looked at us for a few moments, then walked over to stand at the cash register.
"Oh!"
Dinah had rosy cheeks and a mouth that could become a perfect circle.
"There was one of those lived in the apartment across the hall from me and Dan. Miss Figueroa, we used to call her. She was the cleanest creature I ever knew. Dan was the one who had to tell me she was a he. I swear, I couldn't tell at all."
"How is Dan?" I asked. Dinah beamed at me.
"Thank you for asking, Mr. Oliver. Him and me take a walk every evening along the Hudson. He tells me the same stories over and over, and I love him more every time he does."
"Excuse me," the young old white banker boy said.
"He always remembers you,"
Dinah continued, ignoring the young man.
"He says, 'How's that nice colored boy helped Arnold?' I know he shouldn't say it that way, but he can't remember to learn."
"Excuse me," said the banker. "What do you want?"
Dinah snapped.
2 coffees with milk and sugar to go.
For the takeaway window, you make a left out the door and then left again."
She looked at me, raising her eyebrows.
"But I'm late,"
he said.
"Just do this now and I'll use the window after."
"You'll use the window now.
There's a big sign, and I don't like doing the takeaway. That's not a very people-oriented business practice,"
he judged.
"Neither is knocking you upside the head, but I will do just that if you don't move your privileged ass."
A flash of anger passed over the young man's face. He glanced at me and I shook my head. ever so slightly. I'm pretty big and almost as strong as Dinah, so he took the hint and left, muttering wordless complaints.
You didn't have to bother yourself, Mr. Oliver,
Dinah said when he was gone.
I can take care of myself.
I wasn't worried about you, girl. I just didn't want to have to be a witness after you broke his nose and he called the police. This was true. Dinah laughed, and we took a breath to find the thread of our conversation again. Have you seen my grandmother lately, Dee?
She comes over for a smoke most afternoons, unless it's raining or too cold. We go out back while Moira serves the late crowd.
How does she seem?
Wise as a prophet and crafty as a fox. She wishes that your uncle would come by.
He's always working, I said. Uncle Rudolph was in Attica, imprisoned there for an insurance scam so complex that the prosecutors were never able to pin down the exact amount he'd embezzled.
Oh, well,
Dinah opined.
At least Brenda has you. May I help you?
A good-figured blonde asked. She was standing behind the reception counter of the upscale retirement residence. I was liking her style. In her 40s and proud, she wore a green and pink speckled silk blouse to accent a tight black skirt. Some women just don't get old. Joe Oliver, I said. I'm here to see my grandmother.
Does she work for one of the patients?
Blondie asked, as easy as if she were talking about the weather. No. I was losing the edge of my attraction.
She was really confused. Does she work for the facility?
She's a resident, I said. Brenda Naples, room 2709. For a moment, the receptionist, whose name tag read Thalia, doubted me. But then she worked a little magic on the iPad registry.
She is here,
Thalia said. Has been since before you, I said, and will be long after you have moved back to New Jersey.
I'm very sorry, Mr. Oliver.
Me too, I concurred. But maybe not for the same reason.
Baby,
my grandmother said. I had knocked on the open door and then entered her room. She stood up from a chair that was set at a height halfway between a regular seat and a bar stool. Her dress was bright yellow, and her skin the blackness of a night sky. I kissed her lips because that's what we'd always done.
Sit on the bed, darling,
she said, waving toward the single mattress cot that was the main purpose for her room. She fell back into her carpeted wood chair, then momentarily raised her shoulders to prove how happy she was to see me. How have you been, Grandma?
Fine,
she said with a sneer.
That white man, Roger Ferris, keep asking me to go hear some music at Lincoln Center. I tell him every time that I will not go out on a date with a white man. I mean, if it was a double date and he had a white girlfriend and I had a black boy, then that would be okay.
What did he say to that?
That we didn't have to kiss goodnight.
There was a hint of a smile in her scowl. What's that got to do with it?
He says that if there's no kiss, then it wasn't a real date. And that if I knew before we went that there wasn't going to be no lip action, then I wouldn't have to think we were on a date.
That's a pretty good argument if you ask my opinion, I said.
No one asking you.
Roger Ferris, isn't he that guy who owns most of the silver in the ground in the world?
I wouldn't know. The only ground people up in here have is in the cemetery, waiting for the little we got left on our bones.
How's our other friends? I asked.
Stop it, King. You and I both know that you are not here at no 8:30 in the morning to make small talk.
I do love my grandmother. The milestone of 90 years was well behind her, but she read the daily news every morning and did all my sewing. She was a shade under 5 feet tall and hadn't brought the scale up past 100 pounds in years, but she was a power to reckon with. Stonemasons was one of the most exclusive retirement/nursing homes in the world, but something about my grandfather's career as a fireman got him and her put in a benefits clause that I had never seen. Brenda Naples still walked, smoked, and talked back. It's an even bet that she'll outlive me.
What is it, King?
She asked. I told her about the letter from Beatrice Summers and the danger of me following down that evidence. She concentrated with her eyes and ears, and maybe even by scent.